Dr. R.J. Rushduni, RR 152A2, A Religious Dream, The United Nations, Miscellaneous.
In the last century, the poet Tennyson was faced by a personal crisis, his loss of faith. Much as Tennyson tried to retain some form of Christianity, and in spite of the fact that very often in his poetry, he did give expression to Christian sentiments. The basic fact in his life was that he could no longer believe in Orthodox Christianity. The doctrine of evolution had shattered Darwin's faith. As a result, as he looked out at the world, he saw not God's world, but Darwin's world, red in tooth and claw. He saw, he wrote, this earth, a stage so gloomed with woe, you all but sicken at the shifting scene. There was one reality, as Tennyson saw it, to this world. That reality was mutability, change and decay, perpetual flux. Everything passes. Nothing stands. And so he gave expression to this, his basic faith as well as his problem, in a passage in Memoriam, declaring, the hills are shadows, and they flow from form to form, nothing stands. They melt like mist, the solid lands, like clouds, they shape themselves and go. Nothing stands. This was Tennyson's belief and his problem. If we believe that nothing stands, we face a problem. We need, as a counterbalance, to change something that is, in some sense, eternal. That is a source of certainty, an agency of control over change. As an answer to mutability, to change and decay, man can find that source of certainty and agency of control in two directions. He will either find in a transcendental creator God his agency of control and origin, or he will seek it in a human or natural order. But something must give him certainty and world government control. It is inescapable. It's a logical necessity of a man's thinking. There are indeed those who have ridiculed the quest for certainty. The philosopher John Dewey spoke with contempt of the quest for certainty in his book of that title. But what John Dewey did not like was the quest for certainty in the supernatural, in God. What John Dewey did offer was the quest for certainty and the achievement of certainty in a world socialist order, what he called the great community or the great society. The question, therefore, is, what is your source of certainty? God or a human order? Eternity or time? Tennyson, because he had come to the conclusion as he surveyed the world scene, said, because nothing stands, something must be made by man that stands. And therefore, in his poem, Locksley Hall, he looked forward to a world where, in his words, the war drum throbbed no longer, and the battle flags were furled in the Parliament of Man, the Federation of the World. There the common sense of most shall hold a fretful realm in awe, and the kindly earth shall slumber, lapped in universal law. Such a fate was for Tennyson not an act of perversity, but a logical necessity. Man has to have an agency of certainty and control, and he will either have it in God or in a man-made order. And so it is a logical necessity to have this agency of certainty and control, not an act of perversity. Indeed, we can talk about conspiracy in the realm of the UN as we can in any realm, including the churches. Conspiracy dogs every domain of the world. But conspiracy can sustain nothing unless, first of all, it be a need to man. A man without God must make unto himself a God. And the order that he creates, like God, will be man's source of salvation. It will be a saving order. And the UN Charter, in its preamble, begins by declaring, "We, the people of the United Nations, determined to save, have resolved to combine our efforts to accomplish these aims." It is a humanistic organization dedicated to the religion of humanity, dedicated by its own profession to humanitarian principles. Thus we see that man needs an agency of certainty and control to meet the world of change and decay and to give that world meaning. And second, that agency he creates is a substitute God. There will thus be a theology of state, and the attributes of God will be ascribed to the social order. In every area when men have turned away from a supernatural faith, they have created a theology of the state. And this was as true in the 18th century with the doctrine of the divine right of kings as it was in the days of the Roman Empire, when there was not only a theology of state, but when Julius Caesar was assassinated, there was for him a passion liturgy celebrating his death as an atoning fact. Do we have a theology of state attached to or developing in connection with the United Nations? Is it indeed beginning to develop those attributes which make it a substitute God? Now, the first and basic requirement of a theology is the unity of the Godhead. A God cannot truly be God if he is at war with himself. And therefore, whatever is made God must be unified. The basic premise of all theology, whatever the religion, is the unity of the Godhead. Thus, in Christian theology, the doctrine of the Trinity asserts three persons, one God, in perfect unity, without any subordination. Now, in the religion of the humanity, the faith of the one world order, man is deified. And because man is deified and personified in this world order, there can be no division, no disunity tolerated in the Godhead. As a result, this means the unity of mankind is a necessity. There can be no division, no differences, no separation, no discrimination between man and man in this faith. All men must be brought together and made one without any differences. To permit any differences is to destroy the unity of the Godhead. We will return to this in a moment. in any such theology, the basic sin becomes no longer apostasy from God or what we would call moral evil, but disunity. And today among the churches which are infected by this kind of thinking, which have made the one world order their substitute God, and among those who are outside of the churches, the great sin is disunity. And different races, different churches, different organizations must all be brought together. And war, which separates men, and discrimination, which separates men, constitutes the real evil. President Johnson has declared, on a worldwide basis, we place much hope in the United Nations. And he went on to say that the real evil of our time is not sin, but war, whose roots are poverty and ignorance, misery and disease. And in his State of the Union address last month, the President declared, we are entering the third century of the pursuit of American Union. Now, this is a curious interpretation of American history, which he gave in his State of the Union address. According to the men who fought the War of Independence, their purpose was to free this country from a statist invasion and from a centralist power. But according to the President, their purpose was ever-increasing union. Union in terms of civil rights, federal aid, the unity of man with the world he has built, the United Nations, a new immigration policy, and the great society. So that the more men are unified and the more the states lose their identities and the more the people of the United States lose all racial and cultural and religious identity, the more they are merged into one homogeneous mass, the closer we will be to realizing that pursuit of union. This is a religious faith. It is not Christianity. It is the religion of humanity, the religion of the UN. It is the theology and ethics of this new faith in the UN. And it is not surprising that the President concluded his State of the Union address with a doxology, declaring, this is the State of the Union, free, restless, growing, and full of hope. So it was in the beginning, so it shall always be, while God is willing and we are strong enough to keep the faith. But the faith we are to keep, according to President Johnson, is not in God, but in ourselves. The UN Charter in its preamble says that its purpose is to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war. And it goes on to declare in Chapter 1, Article 1, Section 3, that its purpose is to gain fundamental freedom for all without distinction as to race, sex, language, or religion. Language which was echoed recently in California in the Rumford Act. This is a religious standard. It is not a Christian standard. Indeed, it is anti-Christian. But it is religious. And it declares that disunity is the greatest evil, the one great sin of man. And therefore, men must be merged without discrimination as to race, sex, language, or religion. This also means that all religions are equal. That Christianity is in effect outlawed in that it requires one to believe there is one way of salvation, Jesus Christ. That people who adhere to other faiths are lost and can only be saved through Jesus Christ. They are guilty, you see, of discrimination. The goal is the unity and the oneness of man without discrimination, total equality. And total equality means that there are no differences, not only as to race, sex, or language, but no differences with respect to morality. Because if total equality be thoroughly applied, we must insist, as many of them do, and this is a matter of sworn testimony before House committees, by adherents of this faith, that we cannot distinguish between moral acts. When a congressman who is a noted champion of this faith returned from Europe recently and was criticized for having spent money freely and as well having taken a couple of mistresses along as his secretaries, he was told he was not setting a good example, and he said he was, because he was being equal with anything and everybody. And he said, that's what I'm preaching, equality. In other words, there's an equality between right and wrong, good and evil, between all opinions, all peoples. This is the faith of this new religion. Freedom for all, without distinction as to race, sex, language, or religion. And yet, the greatest adherents of this faith are not in the United Nations, but in private agencies, in national agencies, and especially in the clergy, who far surpass the UN in their zeal for world unity. And it is with them a religious dream. This is the answer to all the world's problems. This is the saving situation, the saving order. But the UN itself has dreams of this world order, which is going to save men. And its immigration policies are a part and parcel of this program of world salvation. In a vast number of documents, the UN has spelled out its immigration policy. For example, in the Future Growth of World Population, 1958, this statement is made by the UN Department of Social Affairs Population Division. A new process is about to begin, or has perhaps already been started. And the first signs of that socialization of the world which appears on the horizon may be significant in this connection. What is this new process of world socialization? It is the immigration policy. Now, strictly speaking, the UN does not have an immigration policy. Rather, it proposes, as in this document, simply elements of immigration policy. And in the introduction, it states that no attempt is made to propose solutions for the problems stated. The present study is not to be regarded as an argument in favor of immigration or against it. It simply presents elements for an immigration policy in case anyone is considering an immigration policy. Nonetheless, this document is very, very important. A number of agencies of the UN worked cooperatively to prepare it. The International Labor Office, the Food and Agriculture Organization, UNESCO, the World Health Organization, the Social Welfare Division, and the Population Division of the Department of Economic Affairs of the United Nations, and the International Bank for Reconstruction and Development. Now, as we read this statement of the elements of population policy, we find some very strange paragraphs catching the eye. And the more one reads them and considers their implications, the more disturbing these passages become. Consider, for example, this paragraph. And notice, as I read it, that in this case, the populations, the peoples, do not move, they are moved. The passive verb is used in each reference to the populations. I quote, "A point which may count in favor of immigration, when the cost of settlement is considered, lies in the avoidance of duplication of overhead capital. In the case of transfer of local population to developing areas, the service and housing already provided in the areas of out-migration might be left unutilized or underutilized, thus causing wasteful duplication. In the case of immigration, such waste is avoided since the local population will continue to utilize the services provided for them. Equally, of course, waste could be avoided if at the same time that the local population was transferred, immigrants were moved in to take the place of the transferred local population and to utilize the housing and services already provided for them. In that case, immigrants could be settled to take the place of the transferred population without undue cost of settlement. Where the receiving country is underdeveloped, however, the provision of general services in the areas of out-migration will often be insufficient to begin with." This is a curious statement. Since when are populations moved rather than move themselves? And since when, as a part of the elements of population policy, have we considered moving one segment of population out of an area and immediately transferring another into their homes and places? If these are the elements of population policy, what are we to say of the policy itself? Does it not recall the policy of ancient Babylon and Assyria, where in order to internationalize their empires and break down local loyalties and national loyalties, racial loyalties, loyalties of language, people were systematically moved and scattered throughout the length and breadth of those empires in order to destroy every loyalty possible? But let us read another paragraph. I quote, "A distinction must be made between the settlement of new lands and the placing of new farmers on lands already cultivated. Where agricultural immigration is encouraged as a part of a program for reorganization or diversification of agriculture, involving the transfer of lands already under cultivation to the hands of immigrant farmers, the methods of effecting the change need to be planned in such a way as to produce the least possible disruption of agricultural operations, as well as a minimum of social disturbance and hardships. Schemes may have to be devised to enable the population formerly engaged in the discontinued types of agricultural activity to be absorbed in the new forms of agriculture in conjunction with the immigrants." End of quote. Now, how often do farmers leave operating farms and go to another part of the world, and their farms turned over immediately in order to maintain operation to other farmers from some other part of the world? Immigration is usually prompted by tyranny in the home country and people fleeing from it, or religious persecution, or such a breakdown of economic conditions that it's no longer possible to make a living there. But this contemplates the transfer of already existing farms from people who are moved out to other people who are moved in. Again, these are disturbing elements of an immigration policy. We are further told in this same document that there will be considerable tension as these populations are transferred, but these problems will be taken care of in the second generation as a result of intermarriage. The older generation will be prejudiced, but the younger generation will intermarry and the tension will end. And the great agency, it is stated in this document, of bringing about these intermarriages will be the schools. The schools will be used, it is stated, to socialize, to integrate the children. It is interesting to note that in the current New Yorker for February 13, 1965, there is an article on page 24, rather satirically written, on an organization of which a very prominent, if not leading member, is the Reverend Robert L. Pearson, an Episcopal clergyman who is the son-in-law of Governor Rockefeller. And this group, originally titled the Peace Hostage Exchange Foundation, instituted in 1962 a policy of drumming up support for a program of exchanging millions of people between the United States and the Soviet Union in order to help preserve peace. Today we bring tidings, quoting from the New Yorker, that the Peace Hostage Exchange Foundation has peacefully evolved into an organization called the Citizen Exchange Corps, whose members have continued the policy of drumming up support for a program of exchanging millions of people between the USA and the USSR, with the added wrinkle of facilitating matters logistically by utilizing ships of the Maritime Administration's reserve fleet. This, then, is a program seriously considered not only in the elements of immigration policy, but by a foundation established in this country. If these are the elements of immigration policy as being outlined, where is the policy itself taking shape? On October 2, 1964, President Johnson, in Proclamation 3620, declared 1965 to be International Cooperation Year, dedicated to international cooperation and strengthening world organization. The Kennedy-Johnson bill to take care of this international cooperation by means of immigration has been introduced in the Senate by Hart, S. 1932, and in the House by Seller, H.R. 7700, to repeal the McCarran-Walters Immigration Act of 1952. This new immigration bill, which is quite likely, as far as present indications are concerned, to pass, unless a storm of protest arises with respect to it, has three central aspects. First, Senator Javits has referred to this bill as being the civil rights legislation for the world. Now, I didn't say that. Senator Javits did. When he calls it a civil rights legislation for the world, he means now that immigration will no longer be, if this bill passes, a privilege we extend to peoples of the world. If we find them congenial to us and physically and spiritually congenial and healthy, a privilege we extend to them to come into our country. On the contrary, it will be the right of the people of the world to claim immigration as their privilege. It will be the civil rights legislation for the world. It will put foreign interests above American interests. The idea of an American culture, an American heritage and identity is seen as wrong. A world culture. culture alone is valid, and hence this new immigration bill would seek to destroy anything that would be conducive to our identity. Second, immigration control would be transferred from the legislative branch to the executive branch. Third, the law would be secondary to the president's wishes. It really would be no law, but a blank check to the administration. Already, of course, there have been losses of control as far as our immigration policy is concerned. In 1963, Castro was given the privilege of designating 50% of the migrants to the United States when he demanded it. The State Department agreed. The purpose of these immigration policies is, of course, the unity of the Godhead, to unite the world, to make mankind one. And its premise is not economic, because we certainly do not need immigrants. Its purpose is religious, to unify mankind in terms of this goal of the United Nations. A second basic requirement of an effective theology is the omnipotence of the Godhead. A God is not God if he is not all-powerful. Sovereignty and creative power must reside in the source of certainty and agency of control. Omnipotence has for years, all power, total sovereignty, been steadily transferred from God to the state. And it is now flowing upward from the states of the world to the world state. Similarly, a third aspect of any doctrine of God is that God be all-knowing, omniscient, that he have total knowledge, because total knowledge is necessary to total sovereignty and to total government. God is not truly God. If we can shut him out of our mind, if we can say that, yes, God exists in the outside world, but in my heart, in my mind, I am completely free from God. I can think what I please, and he doesn't know a thing. Then I would be God in the inner world. So that if a God is not all-knowing, he is not God. No God, therefore, can be truly God if he does not control the mind of man. And as sovereignty is being transferred from the God of Christianity to the UN, power is flowing more and more from God to the state and from the state to the total state. Don Bell, in his report of December 25, 1964, referred to this, calling it the hateful parallel. And I quote, "Followers of Christ know one thing, though we try to turn our backs to the fact. God knows our every thought, our every action. He knows all about us, past, present, and future. Though he looks no more on the past, which has been erased by the blood, we have an intermediary to plead our transgressions of the present, and he is able to keep his own for all future. But he is our creator. We are his slaves. And he knows our very thoughts before we even think them, and we cannot hide from God. I know that thou canst do everything, and that no thought can be withholden from thee," said Job. "Shall not God search this out, for he knoweth the secrets of the heart," sang David. "The eyes of the Lord are in every place, beholding the evil and the good. Hell and destruction are before the Lord, how much more than the hearts of the children of men," asked Solomon. The Lord told Jeremiah, "I, the Lord, search the heart. I try the reins, even to give every man according to his ways, and according to the fruit of his doings." And Paul was very definite. "For the word of God is quick and powerful and sharper than any two-edged sword, piercing even to the dividing asunder of soul and spirit, and of the joints and marrow, and is a discerner of the thoughts and intents of the heart. If we look to Christ Jesus as our Savior and Redeemer, then we know and accept the truth that we are slaves of Christ, that he knows all and everything about us. This is his right. Now let's reverse the coin. If we look to state as our keeper, then state has every right to know all there is to know about us. We cannot serve two masters, and if we accept gifts or aid from state, then we must serve state by letting state become the discerner of our very thoughts. We must allow the state to substitute the IBM card for the Book of Life. And we must confess to state all our sins and shortcomings, our strengths and our weaknesses, the thoughts and intents of our heart. We cannot have it two ways. Either we must accept Christ or state as master. We must answer to God or the IBM card. We must have a name written in heaven or a number punched on a card at a data processing center. We can have one of two big brothers, Jesus or IBM. We cannot serve both, else we will hate one. The state today is seeking this total knowledge. And the United Nations is setting up agencies toward that end. It seeks this total knowledge in three ways. One, by control of all education. And there are few schools that have been missed by UNESCO. Second, it seeks this total knowledge through mental health programs. Third, it seeks this knowledge, this total knowledge of us, by controls over our privacy. But to continue, every God also requires worship and sacrifice. And if you want to know what you really worship, examine what it is you really sacrifice for and what you sacrifice to. That is your God. Today we are increasingly compelled to tithe and sacrifice to the state and the world one order, one world order. A tithe of our money goes around the world, better than a tithe, to provide for this one world order. And today, God is getting only the leftovers for most people. Moreover, this one world order already has developed its list of martyrs, its saints. And the references to them are definitely religious. Amersfoort and others as well, and certainly of late, John F. Kennedy. In a book published recently, a collection of poems by various modern poets in honor of Kennedy's death, entitled Poetry in Power, his death is seen as a sacrifice for the world of tomorrow, this brave new world. To quote just a few sentences from the poems in this book to give you an idea of its character, Kennedy is spoken of as a man, but more. Another poet repeats over and over again in one long poem this sentence, "The man is gone on a Friday." The world, you see, has a new Good Friday. He is called by another poet an Apollo, a Caesar, young God without wound. And then the poet goes on to speak of him as being killed by the hate-filled priests of the old religions. He is also spoken of as an incarnation of democracy who lived to be consecrated to Demos. And another poet says he was nailed on the cross of a rightful sight. There is one sentence, however, in the book which I thoroughly liked. the only sentence indeed in what was otherwise a rather distressing and painful book, and it was this: we are stained by his blood. And I thought, indeed, yes. Our Christian faith says that we are cleansed by the blood of Jesus Christ. But all that the adherents of this new religion can say when they present us this young God nailed on the cross of a rightful sight is that we are stained by his blood. This religion cannot cleanse us. Moreover, to continue our analysis of the doctrines of the Godhead which are applied to the UN, a God must be the source of law. God is not under law, he is law. Law is the expression of his being. And wherever our higher law stops, our Supreme Court, there we have our God. When the Constitution was written, it was definitely written, according to Corwin, who is a liberal, under the thesis that there is a higher law above and beyond the Constitution, the law of God. This doctrine has disappeared in our courts. We no longer have a higher law above and beyond the courts. The courts themselves now represent the highest law, and the world court is seen as the world law and the UN Charter as the source of this world law. Law stops, therefore, with the one world order. The one world order, this religion of humanity, becomes the source of law. It has affected even laws in California, which have been ruled constitutional or unconstitutional in terms of it. The new God, therefore, is the one world order. And the economics of this new order again reflect the belief that this order is God. An economics in which man is a creature and God the creator is an economics of scarcity. Man is limited to his God-given portion, whereas in an economics resting on the divinity of man and his order, you have an economics of abundance. Because the world state is God, is able to create out of nothing. Therefore, the basic problem in such an economics is not supply, but distribution. The order can create. Therefore, the only problem is to gain total power and then distribute, because it is a creative order. Again, basic to any doctrine of God is the doctrine of the transcendence and incomprehensibility of God. We as Christians believe that God is incomprehensible, beyond man's fathoming, and yet truly knowable because he reveals himself. So that we can truly know God, but we can never comprehend him. He is too great, too beyond us. It would take the mind that is equal to God to comprehend God. Thus the word incomprehensibility has historically been a theological word attached to the doctrine of the Godhead. In recent years, it has been coming down, being applied to men. Thus, Robert E. Sherwood, in his book Roosevelt and Hopkins, spoke of Roosevelt's incomprehensible power. Recently, as Eric Savary called President Johnson a complex character, compared him to Julius Caesar, and others have hinted of Johnson's incomprehensibility. Similarly, the United Nations is spoken of in similar terms. And we are continually told that we are judging foolishly. We are unable to comprehend the profundity and the wisdom and the great ramifications of every activity of the United Nations, so that we judge rashly when we presume to pass judgment upon its deep and incomprehensible working. This then, to bring this matter to a conclusion, is a religious faith. The United Nations is a religious dream. Its origin is in the apostasy of Western man from Christianity, his creation of another god, a golden calf. When for men there is no certainty, and as for Tennyson, nothing stands, from the very hills are shadows, and they flow from form to form, man, a religious creature, makes himself a god. And the United Nations is that new god being shaped. It's easy to point to the absurdities of the United Nations and of its adherents. For example, recently, according to an anthropological journal, a UNO delegate in New Guinea, going over a territory which only in the past few years has been weaned from headhunting and which is completely backward and primitive, and these missionaries have just barely established a semblance of respect for order. The UNO delegate inquired critically why no university had yet been put up. Again, at the beginning of this month, the IDA, the Institute for Defense Analysis, in its report declared that intelligence gathering is a hostile act. Therefore, we as Americans, and having spies throughout the world, are guilty of hostility. And therefore, since hostile acts are wrong, we should demonstrate that we believe in a one-world order and in world brotherhood by opening our intelligence files to the Soviets, by giving them, in fact, the privilege at any time of asking our submarines to surface wherever they are in the world and identify themselves. We will thereby prove that we are friendly. Absurdities of this sort can be numbered without end. It is easy to ridicule the United Nations. It is easy to point out all that it is planning to do and all that it is doing. But you cannot destroy man's faith in it very readily, because it is a religious faith. They have to have an area of certainty and an agency of control, because they do not have the living God. It is a religious dream and a logical one. And because man is inescapably religious, and order and meaning are necessary to man who cannot live by bread alone, he will either have God to be his God, or he will create a God and worship him. In the last century, capitalism and industrialism gave man a life of remarkable material comfort and ease. But because our culture became secular, irreligious, it left man wide open to the command of new and demonic religious forces. The conspiracies indeed are real. But more basic is man's religious need. And these dreams of a world state meet man's religious need for certainty and an agency of control. The UN therefore meets apostate man's religious hunger for more than bread. And the dream of the United Nations will not abate until men surrender themselves and their every hope and institution and order to the sovereignty of the triune and only God. What we are confronted with is religious warfare between a world order
which has become God on earth and the living God. And in this battle, if God be for us, who can be against us? We have the assurance of victory, but we cannot have it unless we stand and fight in terms of our faith. Thank you.
Questions that you may have, and I'll turn the floor back to Mr. Rajuni, and you may stand and ask your question too.
Yes? The number of the bill. It is in the Senate as S-1932, and in the House as H-R-7700, and it's called the Kennedy-Johnson Bill. Now, there are other bills, I understand, being put in the hopper, which are compromise bills. And I think the thing to do is not only to express your opposition to these bills, but to any change of the McCarran-Walters Act. Because this is a strategy that has so often worked. And I will be speaking, I think it's tomorrow somewhere in this area, on the strategy of subversion. Hit the people with something that's far out. You don't think you'll get it, but if you do, fine. But it's so extreme that people are then ready to settle for a compromise which will give you far more than you hoped to win in the beginning. This is a regular technique. Call for a civil rights bill or any kind of bill that is extreme. If you get it, good. But settle for a compromise far more than you expected in the first place. And time and again, we have seen a radical surrender on the part of many, many conservatives and many congressmen and senators to something that they never would have favored to begin with, because they're so glad to compromise as a means of getting away from the fearful alternative.
Expensive
to move people around. Somebody's got to finance it. And this mass movement of people that is suggested as an element of population couldn't be done without some kind of extensive financial operation, because when people move themselves, they finance themselves. But if they are moved, somebody's got to finance it.
What is the connection that this is a matter of information between the money powers and the National Bank of Reconstruction?
Well, that's an interesting question, because the Federal Reserve System is owned by private banking concerns. We don't have a list of them. The names of the shareholders are not released. It's a private organization, and we don't know who they are. Many people have guesses. Nevertheless, it is owned privately by national and international bankers. Now, the International Monetary Fund is a curious thing, and there's a great deal of controversy behind the scenes right now, because the International Monetary Fund, as it was set up, was a kind of international Federal Reserve. But the world powers have reserved unto themselves the major share of the stock. I believe the U.S. government's share of the stock is something like 27%. So that you have the world politicians saying, we're going to control the IMF, whereas you have the Federal Reserve and all the other similar agencies in the various countries held by these private bankers. And so there appears to be now a tremendous conflict between these private and these governmental powers. And we don't stand much chance from either of them, frankly, but they are quarreling between themselves.
Was Yuthong telling us the other day, Friday, I believe it was, in the Saturday papers, that we should throw patriotism for our country of America out of the window, when he was telling that everybody should forget about nationalism? Was that right?
That is a part of this program, you see, of destroying everything in favor of the unity of the Godhead, the one world order. Of course it's wrong, unquestionably wrong. But if you hold to this religion, you're going to hold to it. A Christian, however, believes that these orders are God-given, that we have a duty under God to respect our heritage. But this is now despised. It seems wrong. And the erosive effect of this is far more than you realize. Most conservatives, for example, believe that they are very conservative and good, staunch people in these matters, in that they fight for the integrity of the United States. But to consider one area where we see this erosion of heritage has penetrated very deeply, and that's in the matter of family. For example, it was quite commonplace 75 and 100 years ago for people to know not only who their fathers and mothers are, but their grandparents and their great-grandparents, and to be able to open the family Bible if they needed to, and to trace back their family for any number of generations. This was just a matter of course. And people could do this because it was important to them. They took pride in their family heritage. My father, for example, could rattle off the names of his parents and grandparents back 15 generations. And this was not an uncommon one. It's gone today. Pride of family means something. And I know that in some parts of this country where, before the First World War I visited, it was an old-fashioned rural area. It was not unusual for people to say that before they married, their folks wanted to know who the girl's family was and who the grandparents were and the great-grandparents. In other words, you had to have a family tree. Are they good people? They're lucky now if they know the girl. Now, all this is part and parcel of the same pattern. If you're going to despise your family, you're going to despise your country eventually. You're going to say that inheritance, heritage, is nothing. And this is precisely what is being done. So most conservatives today are just hanging on to loyalty to the United States and have given up loyalty to place, loyalty to family, loyalty to all these traditional values. And I have found, in checking with various groups when I've been sitting around with some after a meeting, that very few people can name their great-grandparents. Very few. That's a new thing in the United States. A very new thing.
We've been reading recently that there are going to be bill introduced in supporting two state legislatures asking that the Federal Reserve System be purchased back by the Congress. Have you heard of that?
Yes, I have. I think it's very good and very, very important. For this reason, according to the Constitution, at the time of its adoption, in fact, this was one of the great controversies because as it was written, it was intended to eliminate everything except hard money, gold and silver, and copper coins, of course. And in some states, there were some easy money men who got up and said they objected to the outlawing of paper money. But the Constitution outlawed paper money. Now, we've gotten paper money. What does it mean? Look at the bills in your pocket, and they read Federal Reserve notes. The $1 and $5 silver certificates are virtually gone. A $5 silver certificate is a rarity now. If you get one, hang on to it as a souvenir. There are not many of them around. The ones are also beginning to become less frequent. Now, that Federal Reserve note reads that this is an issue of the Federal Reserve. Now, it does not read that you can get gold or silver in exchange. It represents not gold or silver, but debt. When the United States runs into the red, as it did this last year, I believe, to the tune of something like $10 billion, what do? Well, they call up the Federal Reserve Bank and say, well, June 31 is so many months away, and we're already in the red, and we're going to go into the red, we estimate, $10 billion. We need that much money to make ends meet this year. What happens? The Federal Reserve then says, fine, print up $10 billion in bonds and send them over to us. Then the Federal Reserve will call up the U.S. Bureau of Engraving and say, print up $10 billion and turn them over to your treasurer. Now, the day those $10 billion are printed up and circulate and end up in your pocket, it takes the $10 that the $10 bill reads to retire itself. So it takes each bill its face value to retire itself plus interest. Now, only 6% of our money today is hard money. And that goes for gold as well. So, if there were no debt in the United States, there would be no money. And that statement was made by the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, Mariner Eccles, at the end of the 40s during what is known as the McCarthy era. He was before a committee where they were asking some blunt, hard questions. And he admitted, if there were no debt in the United States, there would be no money. As a result, money no longer represents wealth. Since 1913, increasingly, and today past the point of even break-even, it represents total debt. Now, when a country's money is not wealth, but a mortgage, that country is very far gone. So, you have to remove the Federal Reserve. It's the only question of sanity. Because every day we are paying untold millions in interest to the bankers who operate the Federal Reserve. Simply because our money represents debt now.
Do you think there's any possibility of that being done?
I question, frankly, that there is. I think the attempt has to be made.
And I think it has to be made with all the effort possible for the simple reason that these things will slow them down and give conservatives a time for growth and for strength. Ultimately, this debt economy is going to have to crack up. It's reached the point, I believe, where there's any way of going out of it without the biggest economic disaster the world has yet seen. Yes.
Here's a fundamental question on the whole subject of the U.S. I've never been clear on is, if you start back, it seems to me you could say the same things you have said about world government, you could say about national government. And you could drop back if you want to be able to say about state government. In each case, you have a government which is larger, providing law and order for the lower government. The family is controlled by the community by the county by the state by the national. Why do you feel that the national is the point where government must stop?
A good question. First of all, a nation represents a heritage and a unity in and of itself. Whereas there is no international unity culturally or religiously or racially. You have very differing conceptions of what constitutes law. Now, law is an expression of a faith. It's an expression of a morality. When we say that it's a crime to murder, we're passing a judgment. It's a moral law. And all law expresses morality or else a procedure whereby a morality is expedited. Now, you have very differing moralities in the world because you have very differing faiths. And you cannot, for example, take a law structure that a Mohammedan country believes in and put it together with the law structure of a country that is basically Christian in its outlook. Nor can you take the Buddhist heritage and its law structure and unify it with a law structure that is basically, say, Shintoist. These things, unless it has become a fusion of the two, then it becomes a third thing. Now, what these attempts to create a one world order imply is that all these law structures and all the religions representing them have to give way to a new law structure and a new world religion and faith. And we can't agree to this as Christians. Now, moreover, what this order implies is that the central power is to be at the top. We do believe in the Federal Union, but for us as Americans, if we have any regard for our historic American system, and I deal with this in one of my books, This Independent Republic, the basic area of government in the United States historically has not been the Federal Union and hasn't been the states. It's been the counties. Consider for a moment. Your criminal law is basically county law. You are arrested by police who represent the county or a district thereof. You are arrested by them and you are tried by a judge who is elected again by the county or the municipality. If you're involved in a civil suit, again, it is county law, the county court. At every stage, your basic law is on the county level in the United States. And it's only now that the federal government is trying to invade these areas. The invasion by the federal government of the states is not nearly as great as it is the counties. Both the state governments and the federal government are declaring war on the basic unit of American government, which is the county. And that's why, for a long time, for the first 100 years in the United States, the voting requirement, and this is still true in many states, the voting requirement was most strict on the county level, least strict on the federal level. In some states in this union, and I've lived in one of them, when you vote, when you enter the state, you can vote in any federal election, and you can also vote in any state election. But you can only vote in certain county elections if you are a property owner. It's the most important kind of voting. And the county controls the basic tax in the United States, the property tax. Anytime the county loses control over the property tax, you have communism or socialism in a hurry. And that's why today there is a move to take away power from county assessors to Sacramento. Because this is what gives the property, the county, its power. That it is the only body that can vote a tax against the property of the residents, and therefore is responsible immediately to the community and is under the control of the community. Now, this is a very radically different pattern of government than you have on the world level in the UN, and that you have, for example, in Europe. The European states have not been able to resist this drift into socialism and centralism precisely because everything is controlled from the top, whereas for us it's controlled on the county level. And hence the resistance here has been strong. Did you have another question?
Just a moment. Is there any reason, though, why we can't meet on common ground? For instance, at the Nuremberg trials, there was no question in anyone's mind of what genocide was recognized as wrong everywhere by everyone. And to go back to your point about no higher law, it was actually written into these trials that we did recognize a higher law than the mere fact that an officer told some German Nazi to put the gas into a chamber and annihilate a number of Jewish people.
First of all, I think you picked the worst possible example, because the Nuremberg trials represent lynch law. And we set the worst possible legal precedent we could, because we said that without any law, you could execute. And there was no law for the Nuremberg trials. It means that after the next war, anybody can lynch anybody and probably will. The victors will kill without excuse. Heretofore, we have said that where there is no law, there can be no ex post facto performance. But you had no legal precedent for the Nuremberg trial.
You think the genocide was justified?
I didn't say that.
You say there's no crime if there's no law.
As far as a court of law is concerned, the only way you can have order is first to have legal jurisdiction and then to proceed with a criminal offense and a trial, a hearing. The minute you break the processes of law, you create anarchy instead of justice. And we went in there with lynch law in mind. We weren't concerned with evidence because, for that matter, we didn't go after those we felt were guilty, but those that were designated. Now, I suggest you read extensively on the Nuremberg trials and find out what happened. The background of the Nuremberg trials was Tehran. And at Tehran, Stalin said that when we took Germany, the thing to do was to go in there and liquidate 50,000 of their top men. Churchill objected. You'll find this, by the way, in Eliot Roosevelt, As I Saw Him, his book about his father. And then Roosevelt proposed a compromise. He said, by way of a joke, "Well, why don't we compromise between you, Churchill, and Stalin, and settle for $49,500? Their real compromise came later when they decided to hold the trials and just eliminate those whom they wanted to eliminate. The purpose was not justice, it was vengeance. Then, on top of that, Stalin felt so contemptuous of the USA and the British Empire that at the Nuremberg trials, he ridiculed them and he introduced deliberately nonsensical things. For example, he ordered the Russian prosecutors to file charges against the Germans for the Kachin Forest massacres, knowing full well that he was guilty of them, and that the British and Americans knew that he was. Now, these were the charges against the men at Nuremberg. That's not the kind of legal situation I believe in. The trial was a farce, a thoroughgoing farce. And I believe the trial of Eichmann was similarly a farce. I wouldn't have blamed anyone who suffered under him to go out and kill him. He'd take the law into his hands. But to pretend that the lynch law is a different thing. I don't believe it.
We have a clipping from one of the top six papers sometime last year where the union had a committee in Mississippi and one of the
Well, I don't know about that, but I do know that the UN Charter specifically claims total jurisdiction over every country, whether or not they are members. Every country, whether it is a member of the UN or not, is under the jurisdiction of the UN according to the Charter. Second, every bill, act, resolution, declaration, law of the United Nations applies to every country, whether or not they ratify that convention or law or treaty or resolution. Thus, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the Genocide Convention, and other things which the United States has not ratified are still a part of the UN law and therefore do apply to the United States. Now, the only reason these things are not forced onto us is that we have the Connolly Reservation and we are too strong for them to force it upon us. But if and when the United Nations become strong enough and we weak enough, it will make no difference what we think. Any action of the UN will be binding upon us.
This was not on the subject of the evening, but you introduced an answer to the question of assessment of taxes. Is it possible, as is now being attempted, at least by a small group in the Bay Area, to withhold the payment of taxes in rebellion against us, by placing taxes in trust to keep them from foreclosing in that relationship, but if enough or a great enough number of people would thus show the rebellion by refusing to pay property taxes, is this even economically feasible or is it beating your head against the wall?
I don't think I'm competent to answer that question because that's really a legal question. And I think in something like that, it is for a lawyer who knows the situation to analyze the question and answer it.
I was thinking not necessarily the legal aspect, but just from an economic aspect. Would such affect a state enough, for instance, the state of California, to bring enough pressure to bear to do any good?
Well, of course, it would have an effect on the counties where your property tax is concerned.
Well, there have been successful tax revolts in the past, quite a number. I don't know the details of this plan well enough to comment on it, but it has worked in the past to have a tax revolt. And certainly, they had one in Los Angeles not too long ago, which had some result, not too much, but it helped. Yes?
I would have said that the United Nations violated its own charter when it entered into the Tango situation. Would you care to comment on that operation?
Well, the UN claims that, or says that domestic matters are not its concern. In that sense, you might say that it has violated its charter by entering into a domestic situation. On the other hand, it has defined what constitutes an international situation very much as the federal government has defined interstate commerce. And so it has concerned itself, for example, with the treatment of Negroes in the Union of South Africa. It has concerned itself with the internal affairs of many, many a state. So while you can quote one section of the UN Charter against another there, I don't think it works too well to say it was illegal, as some have, simply because there are clauses which do provide for virtually universal jurisdiction, comparable to our interstate commerce. I was interested some few years ago, visiting on an Indian reservation in Nevada where they had hunting and fishing rights as a part of their treaty. And at the beginning of the 50s, they lost their right to hunt ducks because the government said, the ducks don't fall within your treaty hunting rights since they fly from state to state. Yeah, I'm interested in another statement that I've heard made by the CBQ. I'm curious of this subversive attempt at control through trying to treat the mentally ill. I don't follow the connection here.
Will you rephrase your question? I didn't get
it. I believe you mentioned something about that one of the methods of gaining control was through these programs for the mentally ill. I've been curious about this since I've heard this also said by other speakers. What is this subversive effect of trying to treat the mentally ill?
Very good question. And with the indulgence of the rest, I'll take just a few minutes to try to explain that. And this will be the last question, but I do want to go into this. Now, what is mental health? This in itself is a highly debatable subject. There are those who question the validity of the concept. One of those most recently to deal with the subject is a psychiatrist, Dr. Thomas Stephen Zaz, S-Z-A-S-Z, who is neither a conservative nor a Christian, so he can't be accused of being on my side of the fence. But Dr. Zaz, in two books, the first, The Myth of Mental Illness, and the second, and even more important, Law, Liberty, and Psychiatry, has derided the whole conception of mental sickness as a myth. And he has said that the concept is very dangerous to liberty. Now, I refer you to him for an examination in depth from the psychiatric approach to this problem. But to continue with what I'd like to say about it. What is mental health but a substitute term for sin? Mental sickness is a very difficult and nebulous term to define. And the mentally sick, and I differentiate here from those who for physical reasons, are not mentally capable, either through paresis, as a result of ED, or through senility, or through some kind of physical disorder. But those who are mentally sick, what is their basic problem? Well, according to Sigmund Freud and to virtually every person in the field, the basic problem is one of guilt. Now, here is where the differences in the varying schools enter in. What is guilt, and how are you going to deal with it? Now, this, of course, is getting into the area of religion. Christianity maintains that the reason for guilt is the fact of sin. And the answer to sin is salvation. Now, those who believe in these mental health concepts say, well, we do not accept this as a valid answer, and therefore we say the question of guilt or mental sickness must be dealt with by our program of mental health. And the psychiatrists, psychoanalysts, and psychologists of the mental health schools are, as Dr. Maurer of the University of Illinois has pointed out, a new priesthood. Therefore, they are offering a new plan of salvation. And this plan of salvation is the control of man's mind by their concept. Now, for virtually all these men, the answer to the problem of guilt is to accept a relativistic faith. You acknowledge that there is nothing really wrong with you, but that you have a number of problems as a result of your background and training. Now, the problems that arise out of the id, according to Freud, cannot be dealt with except by time and evolution. Those in the ego can, to a certain extent, be dealt with, but the superego represents conscience. The problems there can easily be eliminated in that they are a product of the religious and parental teaching, all the thou shalt not that you hear. By destroying these, you see, you make possible a measure of mental health. The problems of the id, which are rooted in your anthropological past, your primitive evolutionary inheritance, won't be. So you will retain residual guilt in your id, which will reflect itself in your ego. But the sense of guilt that you have in your superego will be eliminated by this acceptance of relativism. So that you have two rival doctrines of salvation. Relativism, it isn't a sin, so it's all right. Or the belief that it is a sin and you are guilty, and God can, through Jesus Christ, give you the power to become a new creature. Now, in the one instance, you submit yourself to God and say, God will be my Savior. In the other instance, you submit yourself to man, or usually the state and a state order, and say, man or the state will be my savior, and I will put myself into the control of these people and their concepts. To me, the whole thing is invalid. It is very dangerous. It is definitely anti-Christian. And therefore, I do not believe a Christian can hold to it. Now, many Christians do, because for them, this kind of mental health has become a new substitute program of salvation. They want to be saved. Where are they going to go for it? To Christ? No, they go to the mental health program. Now, that, briefly, is the reason why I cannot accept it. I do not trust men because the Bible prohibits me from doing so. If I were to have to put my life religiously into the hands of men who claim that they are God on earth, even though they say we are Christians, I would say no, I cannot do it. And if they say they represent a state or a private system of belief, I must again say no to them. I think it's a dangerous thing to place yourself into the hands of men and into the hands of a man-made program of salvation. I have a book on Freud, which will be out later this spring, in which I analyze this whole thing. Freud was a very great man, a very, very profound thinker. But he was not a Christian, of course. He faced the problem logically. He was a brilliant thinker. He saw the logical conclusion. It had to be a program of salvation, one way or another. You had to answer the problem of guilt. And his answer today is the reigning answer. Now, there are variations in how this can be done through psychoanalytic or personal therapy, or through chemical therapy, or through electroshock therapy. But in any of these alternatives, you place yourself into the hands of a man and say that this is my plan of salvation. Is there any who want to ask further questions? Well, we can do it after we are adjourned.
Authorized by the Chalcedon Foundation. Archived by the Mount Olive Tape Library. Digitized by ChristRules.com.